Let's bring the lights up, and I'd like to invite you to reach for your Bible. If you don't have a Bible, what's that? I didn't hear you, hon.
I have like a Mountain Dew.
I still didn't get you.
No more Mountain Dew.
No more. I know. This is my last Mountain Dew. You're right. Yeah. The last cold one, we should say. There are some warm ones at my office, and I'll drink it warm or cold. It doesn't matter. Matthew chapter 15 is where I'd like you to turn. If you can find either your Bible or there's a pew Bible underneath the seat in front of you or underneath your own seat. And we are finishing up with the story that we began last week where Jesus is in a conflict that we've seen repeatedly throughout Matthew with the Pharisees. And this conflict revolves around one main thing that we really haven't got to the heart of, but we're going to get to the heart of it tonight, because if we don't get to the heart of this, we'll miss altogether what is central to Jesus' concern for His mission and for us as His church and His disciples. So Matthew chapter 15, if you're there, we actually are going to pick up where we left off last week in verse 10, but to do that, we need to see what led us to verse 10. So I want to go through the story very quickly that leads to the disciples' lesson from Jesus. It begins with this conflict in verse 1. Then some Pharisees and teachers of the law came to Jesus from Jerusalem and asked, "Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? They don't wash their hands before they eat." This doesn't have to do with hygiene. This has to do with who's clean, who's pure, who's holy, and what does it mean to be contaminated or to be made impure. This is such a deeper issue than just washing your hands, which is what's going to lead into the remainder of our story today. And Jesus does not in any way back down, but immediately takes them on because they're accusing him of not being religious, of not being concerned for holiness and cleanliness and godliness and the ways of God. And so Jesus replies, verse 3, "Why do you break the command of God for the sake of your tradition? For God said, 'Honor your father and mother,' and anyone who curses his father and mother must be put to death. But you say that if a man says to his father or mother, 'Whatever help you might have otherwise received from me is a gift devoted to God,' he is not to honor his father with it. Thus you nullify the word of God for the sake of your tradition." And then he uses a strong word, "You hypocrites, you play actors, those who put on a mask and don't have the inward reality. Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you. 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are but rules taught by men.'" So now he's done in his conflict with the Pharisees, but he's going to speak to the crowds that are around him. So in verse 10, Jesus called the crowd to him and said, "Listen and understand. What goes into a man's mouth does not make him unclean, but what comes out of his mouth, that's what makes him unclean." So the issue is what makes you contaminated, impure, unclean, someone who's not holy, if you will. And for Jesus, he says, it's not the external coming into contact with you that somehow you're contaminated or polluted, that the pollutant begins from within, that there's something that needs to be worked at inside. So now we're done with the crowds and we move to where we didn't go last week, to the disciples. So now the disciples get their special disciple lesson from Jesus. And it all begins with verse 12. "Then the disciples came to him and asked, 'Don't you know the Pharisees were offended when they heard this?'" And if we stopped right here, most people's popular perception of Jesus is, well, Jesus is going to take a few steps back and say, "I didn't mean to offend you. I mean, that's just not how I am. I don't mean to in any way say anything that's harsh or critical. I wouldn't want to undermine your self-esteem or make you feel bad about your attempts to try to live your tradition." But that's not what Jesus does. He instead says, "Yeah, I know they were offended, and let me go straight to the point." He replied, "Every plant that my heavenly Father has not planted will be pulled up by the roots. Leave them. They are blind guides. And if a blind man leads a blind man, both will fall into the pit." So they're not influenced by his father. They are blind, and their course is a destructive course. Jesus says, "Yeah, I offended them because they needed to be offended." Peter still doesn't get it. And so in verse 15, Peter says, "Explain the parable to us." And again, here's Jesus of the Gospels, not of oftentimes our contemporary understanding. "Are you still so stupid, Peter?" That's the word. "Are you still so dull?" I was told I was not to call my kids stupid by my wife. I did anyway. Because, are you dull? You get it in your head. You need to understand. I don't really think you're... Uh-oh, sorry about that. Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I'm wrong. But, and that is the phrase you should hear about after everything I ever say. Are you still so dull? And the message actually translates it. Are you that stupid, Peter? You just still don't get it, so I have to explain it to you again? And Jesus says, don't you see, verse 17, that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach, then out of the body. So it passes through your system, and it enters and it goes out. But the things, verse 18, that come out of the mouth come from the heart. And these make a man unclean. So it's not what is from outside that enters and is eliminated, but it's what's inside that is the source of whatever it is we're talking about when we talk about unclean. And now he describes what these impure, contaminated, unclean things are. Verse 19, for out of the heart come, and this should strike a bell for any of you who know your Old Testament, evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false testimony, and slander. That's the second half of the Ten Commandments. Now, please don't just focus on sexual immorality, because usually when we talk about purity, that's where we want to stay. He instead says evil thoughts, murderous anger, then infidelity, then sexual immorality, and theft, and false testimony, and undermining your brother or sister with false words that will malign their reputation, slander. That all of these things are polluting and contaminating. And he underscores it in verse 20. These are what make a person unclean. But eating with unwashed hands is irrelevant. It does not make you unclean. This is why Jesus is so strongly convinced that the Pharisees need to be taken on about what their understanding is of purity. And what it means to be clean, and what it means to be holy, and what it means to live and breathe the will and the way of God. We have this deep, deep conflict and controversy going on between Jesus and the Pharisees, and the core issue, the thing he's willing to fight for. And you know Jesus is wise, and he knows every battle is not worth fighting. But when he does choose a battle, you should know it's important. And for him, I would argue, since this is at the heart of every battle with the Pharisees and scribes, this is the chief issue for him. This is what separates him from the very religious, devout, holy people called the Pharisees. They're not devils. They're not to be maligned or caricatured. They're concerned about living the will of God. But what separates Jesus is this understanding of what makes one clean and unclean. What it is that actually defiles and what it is that actually makes one pure. And so that's the big issue. And because that's such a big issue, in verse 20 we're talking about clean and unclean. What I want to do is do an extended reflection with you on something that we often don't think about because it seems on the surface to have nothing to do with our lives. I would argue it has everything to do with our lives. Our culture, the way we view the other, the way we understand what it means to be holy and to be loving, what it means to either embrace or to exclude. It has so many facets in what we do because unclean and clean is something that we all have to wrestle with. What does it mean to be pure? What does it mean to be holy? What does it mean to be defiled? And where's that come from? Does it come from outside me? Or does it come from within me? And if it comes from within me, I have to do a certain work here. If it comes from outside me, I need to erect some walls and build some barriers and make sure that I'm not contaminated and polluted by all that's outside me. So this becomes a big, big issue. And where we want to start with this reflection is understanding when we talk about clean and unclean, we're talking primarily about boundary and identity issues. You don't wash your hands, Jesus, according to the tradition of the elders. The way the Pharisees identified themselves is they were going to live out the priestly commands to wash their hands just as the priest did, even though they weren't conscripted to. They didn't have to do it, only the priest did it during worship. But they were going to do this in order to show their utmost holiness. And because they were committed to this, that identified them. They were identified by not eating with the Gentiles, by making sure if they were contaminated or polluted by any Gentile influence out there, that they washed their hands to make sure that that pollutant, that contaminant, would be wiped away. So this is a big identity issue. It has to do with you and the other. And the best example I can give of this, and all of my examples will be gross tonight, I'm sorry, but clean and unclean is all about clean and disgusting. If you were to spit in a cup 3 or 4 times, you know, three or four times, and then someone were to ask you after that, drink the cup, you wouldn't do it. Probably wouldn't do it. The reason you wouldn't do it is really interesting, because it's your saliva. It was in your mouth just a moment ago. You had no trouble swallowing it. It's part of you. It's there. It's something that is inside you, and you don't think twice about it. But once it's spit out, it's no longer saliva. It's spit. And it's disgusting to drink your own spit, even though you've been swallowing your own spit, although you called it saliva. There's a certain disgust mechanism at work, and the issue is, as soon as you spit it out, it's foreign, it's other, it's something that's disgusting because it's outside of you. Now, we could use other examples of things we eliminate and do with our bodies, and you'd get the same point, but I'm using spit in order to just stay there. There's only one orifice through which we expel anything that we're not disgusted by. And that's tears. And it's a very unique thing to human beings. And it's a wonderful thing we could veer off of, but we're not going to. But everything else, once it's outside of us, it's foreign, it's alien, it's disgusting, it's foul. And we have a certain disgust mechanism within our minds and psyches that regulates what we will do with this foreign, foul thing. And for the most part, that works to our advantage. Because there are a lot of foreign, foul things that we don't want to take into our body because they could be toxic, they might be not nourishing, they might be diseased, they might be dangerous. There are all kinds of things that we're disgusted by, and that, in a natural way, keeps us from taking them back into ourselves or taking them into ourselves from a foreign source. Disgust is a universal expression. You know how psychologists and sociologists do studies and they say different facial expressions are cross-cultural, they universally translate. Smile is one of them. The disgust expression, which is the wrinkling of the nose, like, oh, smelly, and the lifting of the lip. And the idea is that all cultures universally have this expression that they're disgusted, there's a certain foulness and a nauseating quality to this thing that's disgusting, and your lip curls because you're going to expel it. If it gets in your mouth, gets in your body, you're going to get rid of it. So there's a certain curling of the lip. That's actually a good thing. Disgust is good for the most part. What's interesting is it's mostly a learned behavior, though. Take an infant, a little baby. For the most part, they have little or no disgust mechanism. They'll put anything in their mouth. They'll take anything in. And they do that because they just don't have a disgust mechanism. Now, over the course of time, and maybe through bitter or bad experiences, you begin to develop certain disgust mechanisms that allow you to vomit or expel something from your body so it doesn't become part of you. But for the most part, many of the things we're disgusted by are very cultural. The best example of this is there's a lot of foodstuffs we could eat in our ecosystem. A lot of foodstuffs. But we as Americans don't tend to eat things like bugs, or worms, or dogs, or brains. Now, we don't have any trouble with someone raising chickens and slaughtering a chicken and eating that. But here in the West, in America, if they slaughtered their dog and had him for supper, we'd think something's wrong. In other cultures, they wouldn't have any issue with that. And the issue is what disgusts us, and this is important, is often learned. It's something that we take in either from our culture or from our experience, and we have very legitimate things that don't disgust other people but disgust us, and we realize that the challenge with our disgust mechanism is when it's working properly, it's very good. It keeps us from toxic things, diseased things, cultural things. You wouldn't want to have a dog barbecue here in Wisconsin. I mean, that would just be disgusting. We're just not used to that, even though other cultures might. But when you begin to take that learned disgust mechanism and impute it to despised peoples, then all of a sudden that which has been a learned behavior, which is a reflex to want you to expel and be nauseated and feel sick, becomes a very, very dangerous thing, which the Pharisees had done with the Gentiles, which they had done with even Jewish people who failed to live according to their tradition. They found them to be unclean, disgusting, polluted, contaminated. Now that kind of culture disgust can be very innocuous. Think of kids on a playground playing cooties. I did it when I was a kid. You know, girls have cooties. So I don't want to be near you. Don't touch me. Don't get near me. Don't breathe on me. Don't be in my vicinity. And, you know, when you're doing that as a kid, there's a certain naivete toward it. You're just kids. But when you take that same socio-moral disgust and scale its intensity, you find it can be the engine behind the worst human atrocities possible. You think of our nation's founding and the disgust over the African American. You think of the world wars and the attributing of pollutant and contaminant to the Jew. So they must be expelled. They must be eliminated. You think of our current day where for some Muslim or homosexual is disgusting and it needs to be eliminated. And there's just no reaction except for just disgust. I'm nauseated. And you realize when disgust becomes a learned behavior toward others, it can be a very dehumanizing thing. And it tends to do that because part of that boundary identity issue is not just who I am, but who are my people. And when you're in my tribe, and my closest tribe's my family, well, I'm going to do everything I can to keep you from being polluted, contaminated, harmed. But if I expend my tribe to my church or to my nation, well, then anyone who's outside of it, they have the capacity to be disgusting. Less than human. Someone who is a contaminant. They're repelling. They're just nauseating. They're someone I don't even want to think of as having human dignity or having any value other than me being one who just wants to expel and eliminate them from my life. And that's what we see with the Pharisees. Their purity is going to come through expulsion. And they see the Gentile and the disobedient Jew as a contaminant and a pollutant. And that disobedient Jew and Gentile contaminates them. And once they're contaminated, all they can do is say, we've got to wash this filth off. And not only that, for the worst of them, we must expel and eliminate those people so that they're not a bother to us anymore. The reason why it's important to look at unclean and unclean in these categories is once you go there, and it's easy to go there, and perhaps you can think of a people group or a certain political party or people that have a certain ideological stance, and you can begin to dehumanize them, belittle them, begin to degrade them, see them as less than human, think of all the name-calling, bigot, idiot, all that, and you realize it's very easy to go there. And once you've gone there, then understand that it's pretty hard to ever then redeem that person. Because the power of a pollutant is great. And this is the end of our heavy reflection on this. And I got to use two psychological terms, but they're very important for our text here. The reason why it's impossible to purify someone who's polluted is dose insensitivity, which sounds very clinical, but all that means is it just takes a little bit of pollutant to contaminate the whole. There's a hair in my soup, waiter. Oh, we'll just pick the hair off and eat it. No, I want a new soup. Well, it's not a bowl full of hair with a little soup. It's that little hair that contaminated the whole. Or you have a bug in your orange juice. And let's say you even crush the bug. And you say, oh man, I got bug in my orange juice. And you say, well, psychologically, intellectually, I should be able to filter that bug out and maybe boil that juice over and maybe filter it one more time. And then it'll be clean. But probably most of us would just get another cup of juice. Because once a minute amount of pollutant has touched something, all of a sudden the whole is contaminated. We don't think of something as a little contaminated, a little polluted. We instead understand that that little tiny bit has made the whole poisoned, the whole thing's ruined. You attach that idea of dose and sensitivity to this, and you'll see my point, hopefully, if you're following, and then it'll get easier and we'll conclude and have some time for discussion. It's negativity dominance, and the point here with negativity dominance is it places all the power on the side of the pollutant. If two more disgusting illustrations. If a little urine falls in your wine, the wine didn't make the little bit of urine just scrumptious. The little bit of urine has power to defile the whole. The negative dominates over the positive. One last one, and I'm sorry, but this just helps us get at it. If someone touches a little... I'm sorry. I really am. But it makes the point. If someone touches a little fecal matter to your cheeseburger, the cheeseburger doesn't make that little bit scrumptious. That little bit ruins the whole. And the reason is the pollutant's more powerful. The pollutant ruins the whole. And this now brings us to Jesus and the Pharisees. They see him coming into contact with a juice that's got bugs in it, with soup that's got a hair in it, with spit, with things that disgust them. And in their mind, that little bit of pollutant ruins the whole. It has the power to make him, no matter how much he tries to stay clean, completely unclean. It ruins Jesus. It makes him foul and disgusting in their eyes. When what Jesus is doing is realizing, if you make people or outsiders unclean like this, it's impossible to redeem them, because the negative will dominate over any positive, and just a little pollutant makes the whole thing ruined, and you never make it possible for the ability to come into contact, to redeem, to restore, to clean, to make whole. You instead have to erect boundaries around yourself and make it so that you're never ruined by all that defiling pollutants that are out there. And Jesus, of course, in his whole ministry has been more than willing to touch the leper and to eat with the sinners. And in our very next story, talk to a Canaanite woman and wrestle with her about faith. And what we begin to see is Jesus doesn't see that the outside pollutant makes anything unclean. He instead says the uncleanness is right here. And you can't protect yourself by having boundaries. And in fact, if you build those boundaries, you'll find that you're in a captive cage to your own uncleanness. Because being clean means reaching out in love to the unclean, to those who are considered to be pollutants, who are defiled by sin, and coming into contact so that cleanliness is transferred through redemption and through healing, instead of that cleanliness being captive in the illusion of thinking you're still clean in this cage that's been erected that supposedly keeps one pure. Now, where this really comes into practice for us is if Jesus is speaking to his disciples, and we come back to verse 15, Jesus is speaking specifically to his disciples. He's frustrated that they don't get it. He's frustrated that they don't see what's so important. It just seems to bypass them because he has a mission for them. He's trying to get them to join him on his mission. And if he lets them hold the Pharisees' view that somehow there's a contagion and a pollutant and they can't go out, then hospitality, the embrace of the other, the embrace of the holy other, the foreigner, the one who has different cultures and different practices and different lifestyles becomes impossible. You just can't do it because you've decided that the boundary of cleanliness is me and my tribe, and everything else is unclean, so we erect boundaries rather than embrace. There's an exclusion instead. So you're not part of our tribe. You'll just make this unclean. He understands that disgust, for the most part, except when it's natural, having to do with things that could really hurt us, again, disease, toxic stuff, he understands that disgust, when it's applied to social groups and to people groups, erects boundaries, while love tends to dismantle those boundaries. And if Jesus' ministry is anything, it's a constant dismantling of these boundaries that his tradition has put up before him to define cleanliness as something that is preserved in yourself by staying away from contact with the others. Whereas Jesus is always there with the marginalized and the impoverished and the people that are rejected and the people that have no voice. There's something incredibly wonderful there because he understands that you have to make those contacts, which may be initially disgusting and uncomfortable and challenging. And most likely those who hold to the Pharisees' view of holiness will see as impious and irreverent. As you're just a drunkard and a sinner, which they said in Matthew 11. You're a drunkard and a friend of sinners. Well, that's Jesus' piety. He's not cut himself off from those that his society has said will pollute him. He instead is going forward in order to embrace that which is often expelled and excluded and considered contaminated. If you want a couple of case studies in this as we draw to a close, the rest of the New Testament we'll be reading is all about trying to dismantle this kind of system that is so firmly in place with the disciples that Peter will have to have a dream in Acts 15 where three times he sees the Lord and the Lord says, "Eat this." And Peter, "I can't, it's unclean. It's unclean, that will pollute me, I'll be contaminated." And the Lord three times says, "Eat it." And then after Peter goes through this three times, God says, "Don't you dare call unclean what I've called clean." And he's talking about the Gentiles. Paul will say in Romans 14, "I've come to believe that nothing is unclean." And so he says, Jews and Gentiles, you better get along in the church because Jews and Gentiles have different food laws, different ideas of what's contaminated, what's holy. He'll address the Corinthians who are trying to eat meat in this big city where being most of them impoverished, the most opportunity they have to eat meat is when there's a big idolatry session and gods are worshipped, and that's when the meat is plentiful, cheap meat, and they'll get the meat and they'll wonder, should we eat this? It's been given over to a god. And Paul will say, "It's nothing. Eat it. Eat it." Unless someone's going to say that somehow you have some connection to that god because of it, then you might want to make sure they know you have but one god, and it's the God of Jesus Christ. But otherwise, Paul says, "Eat it. So what?" You find that this table fellowship is such an issue that in Galatians, Peter will go and eat with the Gentiles, and then he'll stop. And Paul will have to write him and say, "Peter, you're a hypocrite. Eat with the Gentiles. You can do it. It's not contaminating you." So the issue is, this is such a big issue, this guilty by association, that it has to be addressed again and again and again and again. In my own history of working in churches, it's had to be addressed again and again. One of the reasons I got into such big trouble at my first church is, hey, you're reading liberals, you're reading conservatives, you're reading Catholics, you're reading Eastern Orthodox, you're reading progressives, you're reading this. How could you do that? That's unclean. That's going to just defile you. Because you stay in the tribe. The tribe's clean, but anything outside, which is other. Or you could see it if all of a sudden I said, "Hey, I want to make a positive connection to some Muslim leader so that we show some kind of solidarity and support." "Oh, no!" Or, you know, "We want to baptize a homosexual couple who want their baby to be baptized," which we've already done. I've already done. It's like, what? So all of a sudden you realize that we are wrestling with issues where that guilt by association, where somehow we seem to think that maybe we're polluted by that which is outside of us, instead of seeing the pollutant is all these things that keep us from loving. And that's what verse 19 is full of. Evil thoughts keep you from loving others. Murder keeps you from loving others. Adultery and sexual immorality keeps you from loving others. Theft and false testimony and slander. The uncleanness is what keeps you from being a redemptive influence and agent in the other's life. Because you're doing all these things that undermine them. And so the uncleanness is inward, going outward, and never outward, coming inward. Well, the most important example, well, there's one more that is very interesting to me. 1 Corinthians 7, you don't need to turn there, but in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul's writing to a very troubled church about marriage and remarriage and divorce and other things. And there's an interesting thing he says, which hopefully gets this across just as well. In 1 Corinthians 7, verse 12, listen to this. To the rest I say, I not the Lord. If any brother has a wife who's not a believer and she's willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who's not a believer and he's willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. Here's why. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife. And the unbelieving wife has been sanctified or made holy, made clean through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. So the holiness is something that's imparted rather than being contaminated by the believing spouse and the unbelieving children. It is something that's imparted to them. It becomes transferred. And that's the point. That's at the heart of what's going on between Jesus here and the Pharisees. It's also what's going to be at the heart of next week's lesson, and it's so fitting that you see as we go through Matthew, as it's meant to be gone through one story by the other, that Jesus is going to make his point very powerfully in verse 21 with what my Bible heads as the faith of the Canaanite woman. Canaanites were slaughtered in the Old Testament. They were in the Holy Land. They're in our land. They're unclean. They must be eliminated. They must be expelled. Now, a Canaanite woman, and at the time of Matthew's writing, there are no Canaanites. They don't exist. So this is a Gentile. It's a way to allude to the Canaanite stories, but we have a Gentile. And this Gentile woman is going to come and plead with Jesus, and we're going to see him have a challenging discussion with her, which is on the border of being offensive, a very challenging and interesting discussion. But at the end, he will applaud her faith. You have faith, woman. How could I deny redemption and healing and cleansing and welcome? Whereas the Pharisees, who are Jews, steeped in their tradition, committed to the law, blind guides, hypocrites. They are dull. In other words, he says, they're not of my Father. They haven't been planted by my Father. Those are fighting words, people. Those are fighting words where he has welcomed the complete outsider and he has disregarded those who seem to be closest to where he's at. So much so that it's important to note that he's willing to fight over this. And I love that phrase, and we'll end with this. Look at verse 14. When he's talking about the Pharisees, leave them alone. Jesus doesn't decide that he's going to keep pounding them over the head with this understanding of clean and unclean that he has. And the reason he is he knows he'll never get past their disgust. That one of the hardest things about interacting with people about political issues, religious issues, and other things is sometimes there's an inherent disgust that is so deeply emotionally held that you just can't get past that. It just, there's an immediate recoiling and a certain sense of, I could never talk to that person. I could never try to understand them. I could never. And we understand that's what we're talking about. And Jesus, instead of trying to appeal to the Pharisees to get them to change, says, hey, disciples, here's what we're going to do. We're going to leave them alone. Let them figure out where their path's going to lead them. Let them see the trail it will take them down. And maybe then they'll get it. Maybe the truth will win out in the end for them. But for now, we're not going to keep fighting them over this because all we're going to do is allow disgust to be against disgust. Because Jesus will say, I'm disgusted by them, they're disgusted by me. And so it's just not going to get anywhere. And Jesus is willing to look very impious, to look very unholy in his way of showing godliness to the religious folk. And that in the end is going to get what's going to get him crucified. He's the friend of sinners. And it's that very thing, that willingness to break the boundaries between the holy and the sinner, that we say when only by grace are we welcomed, only by grace do we stand. How are we clean? Well, we're clean by the grace of Jesus. So that it's that very grace we celebrate. Jesus, what a friend of sinners. And we're celebrating the fact that he's willing to go head to head with the most religious and devout people of his time and say, you've completely misunderstood what sin is, what purity is, how one becomes clean, and how one becomes unclean. And that's important for us to remember as well, so that we don't make the same mistake of the Pharisees, because they were deeply devout and religious folk. So we have to work on our disgust mechanisms. One last story I'll tell. It's not on my notes, but it's a wonderful story in a book I read called Unclean. There's a saint, and I wish I could remember her name, but here's what this saint did. She understood these ideas about clean and unclean so well that she did something that I'd never do. But she was trying to portray in an example how she was willing to break these boundaries between clean and unclean and between herself and the other. She had someone that she was working with that was deeply, deeply sick, and she had this bowl full of pus that had come out of the person's body. She drank it. Now, I'd never do that. And I wouldn't recommend you do that. But saints are odd people. And you are all, I think, wannabe saints. They're very odd people. And sometimes they do strange things to make a point. And that's what she was doing. It's not like she was going to make a diet of doing this. But this was her way of saying, this person and the wound they have, and wounds often seem to us to be very disgusting because your body's breaking, and when blood comes out, that's the other, or, you know, it's disgust. There's a certain disgust. But she refused to let that disgust mechanism keep her from seeing that person as a person of dignity, worth, value, that needed to be cherished and loved and embraced. And in that moment for her, embrace meant, I'm going to completely embrace you in all your brokenness. Do you get that? It's just an example. It's not something you should do. Unless, of course, you want to do it. I wouldn't stop you. I don't think I could watch. All right. Worship team, if you make your way up here. A lot of things in tonight's message. A lot of perhaps new ideas. But we're taking that clean and unclean to levels that I think the scriptures are actually inviting us to. Any thoughts, comments, questions before we get going with our prayer time together? Was that last one too nasty? I'm sorry. I just felt, you know, I felt like I've gone so far now. I mean, I just keep going lower and lower. I might as well go with the lowest one I know. Just because that sticks with you, doesn't it? It stuck with me. It's not like it's in my notes, but it stuck with me. Yeah. You're welcome. Let's all think of ice cream for a while. Unless you're intolerant to yeah, if you're lactose intolerant, then I haven't helped your disgust mechanism at all. French fries, pizza, puppy dogs, kitty cats. Not as food. Yeah.
So, you know, we want to give our love and do what Jesus did, but we have to be careful about, like, talking about boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's always important, because there's the book I just read, and I'd recommend it to anyone. It's called Unclean by Richard Beck, and I read it over the last 2 weeks knowing I was preparing for this, and it really, really challenged me. And a lot of the material I presented, I've gleaned from him. And he actually talks about two things in regard to that question. The first is that clearly there is a value to what people call margins or boundaries in our lives. But he says, don't be too quick to accept the personality theory underneath it, because the personality theory is usually the lone individual. And he says our personality theory always must be influenced by what it means to be a person is to be a person in community. The triune God influences our sense. And so sometimes in reaching out and loving others, and you can imagine this most clearly with a parent and child or a husband and wife, to love the other person takes its pounds of flesh out of you. You don't have quite the nice margins and boundaries you think you have. And he actually argues too many times our understanding of charity or helping others is we help over and above our comfort level. So we've got so much money and we got plenty of money to live on, so we'll give them the 10 extra bucks we got instead of the widow who has 2 cents to live and gives it all. That there's a certain sense in which sometimes those are helpful things to keep in mind, but we always have to wrestle with the fact that the gospel calls us to not just be comfortable and help others, but deny yourself, take up your cross, follow me. And I wouldn't in any way attempt to explain how that works with different people in their different relationships, but I think that's where wisdom comes in. The wisdom of knowing if I help this wounded, broken person too much, I might end up sinking down with them instead of me lifting them up. And then you bring wisdom into that and understand I'm no good to them if I'm sinking while they're sinking. There are people in my own life that they are people that are, I've erected a boundary up against because we get nowhere. We just hurt each other. We don't help each other when we're together. We cuss at each other. So it's just, there's no reason to try to make something of that other than to learn that sometimes things can get so malignant and tumorous. And he uses this last thing, which I'll give. There is a place for expelling. 1 Corinthians 5, the believer among you claims to be a believer. He's doing something that in the Gentile world is considered disgusting. He's having sex with his mom and her daughter. And it's not just we that think that that's wrong, but the whole world does. And they're told, expel him. So you got to do something with that. So as much as we want to embrace Jesus, make sure that we keep that wide welcome, there is a place to finally say the cancer's so great that there must be an excision. So that's where I think individual cases become very challenging. But the overall idea becomes don't eliminate all contact with sinners and people who seem to be unreligious and unconcerned about the law and unconcerned about faith simply because you've determined that they will defile you. Make sure that you have understood that you are bringing and transferring in some ways cleanness and holiness because you're bringing them not adultery, sexual infidelity, theft, slander. You're bringing them love and encouragement and support and welcome. So that's kind of what's going on. But for individual cases, there's always wisdom. And to me, that's the beauty of the book of Proverbs, which we've gone through, the book of Ecclesiastes, and even some of the Psalms and the book of James, that there's a certain wisdom that has to come in with individual cases that makes it so we don't end up becoming a martyr while we're trying to actually, for no reason at all. You only become a martyr if there's no other possible way. If possible at all, remove this cross from me. If possible. But if there's no other way, then we go that. You see what I'm saying? So it gets very complex at that point. But everything's complex, if you like being complex.